is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fire Drop It. My name is Scott, here with Michael Drew. As always, this is the Elder Scrolls Podcast. Today, we are talking about a requested topic because way back in the day, we did the Elysian Empire and the Riemann Empire, but we never did a sort of dedicated episode on the Third Empire and the Septim Dynasty because we kind of like touched on it a little bits here and there with the Imperials and we're talking about Talos and such like that. So we're going to actually go through the entire dynasty and talk about the Third Empire. And it's actually one of the most detailed
It's very dynasties. Detailed. Despite being quite small on the timeline compared to other times of history, there's a lot that goes on here. I mean, compared to other empires as well. I think one of the most interesting things about the Third Empire is just how much conflict and bad things and chaos there has been within its time span. I mean, especially like when you play Oblivion and you're a kid, there's this feeling, well, at least we were, there's this feeling that the Empire is this like sunshine and rainbows, beautiful thing with no problems, you know, like they're the good Empire. They've, you know, they've got shit down and you know, nothing is going to go wrong. But the reality is, as soon as Tiber Septim basically conquered all of Tamriel, it was kind of downhill from there. Like he declares the Third Empire and it just basically goes from being fully unified to just degrading with, you know, some upswings along the way of like, oh, but then, you know, this emperor did some good stuff, but there's a lot of bad and a lot of strife as well. So there's a lot to unpack today.
And once you look at the family tree as well, calling it the Septim Dynasty, it's dynasty, you're stretching that word a bit because the sheer amount of like different families and, you know, connecting Tiber Septim to say Uriel Septim the Seventh, it's just a million miles of disconnect between them and everything that's gone on in the meantime. So it is one dynasty, one empire, but really there's kind of nothing really connecting the end of the line with the start of it.
It's more just like a nice title and an honorary thing. And of course, with the Amulet of Kings, you have Akatosh blessing essentially the person kind of being coronated as emperor, as having dragon blood, because really, Scott, you know, you made the video on the Septim Lie, and most of the Third Empire, they don't come from Tiber Septim's balls, do they? His brother's daughter, basically, quickly becomes empress, and then it all descends from there. So it's kind of like it all descended from Tiber Septim's father.
Yeah.
So
unifying link.
Yeah, like in a way.
And then obviously Tiber Septim as a character, like, you know, you get the whole Talos of it. More is he like an org kind of thing, or is he Hjalti early beard? There's a lot of stuff around him. Is he three people, one people? You know,
So in a way, it's not even the Septim dynasty because Tiber Septim's father, whether you buy into the kind of Hyrok origins or the Atmoran origins, is not a Septim anyway, because that's what Tiber Septim, Talos or Hjalti Earlybeard decided to use Tiber Septim as his imperialized name so that he'd be more accepted by the populace. So Septim really has nothing to do with anything other than just choosing to take that name for his extended family.
It's all one big meme, basically. However, what actually does legitimize it? So it's more like a misconception than a meme, because if you can wear the Amulet of Kings, unless there's some like, you know, crazy sorcery involved, you kind of, you know, you have to have the dragon blood or it basically you can't wear it, right? So they do, but it's like it's given to them when they become emperor, you know, or you're thought to be chosen by Akatosh at least. And that's one of the interesting things, you know, when you get into theories about is the dragonborn going to be the emperor? It's kind of like he does send these people which do become emperors, you know, like Riemann, the Akaviri invasion happens. They're like, oh, you're dragonborn, basically.
Yeah.
And then the Riemann dynasty comes from that. So it'd be interesting. Like, imagine a situation, especially, I know we're going a little bit off topic here, we'll get back to it, but imagine a situation where Elder Scrolls 6 is actually set a little bit further in the future than anyone expected, right? Especially, I mean, there's been so long since Skyrim was released in 2011. Imagine if the Dragonborn is an older figure and the current emperor is like the Dragonborn's son. I think that would be cool. Like if I'm just like kind of like brainstorming,
even a way to like bend with the canon. I mean, it would make like the Dragonborn like a male in this scenario, but like, you know how like whatever you breed with the child is that the race of the mother. So for example, if you had an imperial
like empress or something, or emperor, whatever. You could just say that the wife of the dragonborn was an imperial, whatever, and therefore the next race. It might be easy. Obviously, that doesn't work.
It gets tricky
and stuff, but
yeah, it gets tricky, especially when you look at hereditary stuff for being dragonborn. One of the most obvious reasons why it's a divine blessing of sorts is because you could just basically, you know, breed. You could breed dragonborns, and you know, you'd have all these people who, you know, could basically learn the Thorm, and like you'd have, you know, if this dragonborn has like, you know, a bunch of kids, then they have a bunch of kids. You just have like a whole army of, you know, dragonborns, which, you know, we can assume that's not really how it works. Otherwise, yeah, the Empire would be the most powerful force on the continent of Tamriel. I mean, maybe they are and they just don't know it yet, but
Because, I mean, the idea of what it means to be dragonborn and to have the dragon blood becomes so kind of hazy. Yeah. Because, you know, the idea that all of these emperors would have been eligible to wear the Amulet of Kings and would have the dragon blood, it actually gets a bit hard to believe. And, you know, it, depending on what you buy into with Tiber Septim, and, you know, whether there's this great deception that he really doesn't have any kind of significant talent beyond being a capable general, and it was actually, you know, it was Ismir Wolfharf who is the one who has the dragonborn powers and understands the way of the voice, etc., etc., then that means Tiber Septim was kind of just, most of it was a lie. So you could almost imagine that they would go through these processes, like, you know, the lighting of the dragon fires, all this stuff doesn't really necessarily mean anything, and they can kind of just fake it, and maybe they have an alternate Amulet of Kings that is just like a knockoff.
A ceremonial,
they just give to whoever's in charge. Yeah, like the idea that things could just be ceremonial wouldn't surprise me with
it's also chaotic. The Elder Council, you know, they basically just choose who's in charge,
and they run the show, don't they? For the most part,
they've got the real one locked in some chamber, and they got the fake one.
And that's the obvious flaw with the end of the thing, that like, you know, you have Uriel Septim the Seventh, and his three sons are dead, and only Martin Septim. And it's like, well, that's not like, usually there's a cousin, and like, as it happened before in the Septim, there's this huge break in the Septim dynasty where they had to get like basically a distant cousin more closely related to it, and then they just start fresh. But it's just like, yeah.
Hey, well, maybe that's how, we'll get to the history, but I was just going to say, maybe that's how Menkar Cameron did it. You know, he like got the Amulet of Kings, hid it in a box, and then he comes out in Lake Arya's caverns wearing a fake one that he's made. And he's like, ooh, look at me, I'm so cool. Anyway, well, getting into history.
I'm just thinking of like Johnny English with Sauvage, like a fake Archbishop of Canterbury stealing the Amulet of Kings.
Like I said, I was listening to A Man for All Seasons to pump up for the podcast.
Okay, Martin Septim is just Johnny English.
That's it.
He just lands on the throne. Continue.
We can kind of quickly talk about like Tiber Septim, because we had a full episode. Yeah,
he rules for 38 years. He outlives his son, but his grandson, Pelagius, he basically ascends to the Ruby Throne, but then he gets assassinated in, like, what, 3 years? And then...
By the Dark Brotherhood.
By the Dark Brotherhood.
Which is of note.
And it's in the Temple of the One, is it? A lot of things happen in the Temple. So, anyway, someone dies there. Uriel the Kintyra comes into the picture.
Well, yeah, so let's just say, like, Tiber Septim has a brother called Agnarith.
Yeah.
So Tiber Septim's grandson, Pelagius, killed by the Dark Brotherhood. So then it goes to Kintyra Septim, who is Agnarith's daughter, aka Tiber Septim's niece.
Yes.
So this is Septim line comes from.
And she has Uriel.
Yeah. Septim the First.
Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting how... It's kind of confusing when you look at, like, dynasties, how they'll have, you know, Uriel Second, Uriel the Third... It makes you think it's just one person naming their son the same thing over and over, but it's actually not. Like it's kind of like different people picking the same names, and then they just put like the three or four on the end.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And, you can't have the two with the same name being rulers, regardless of who their parents are.
Yeah.
And by the way, this Empress Kintyra is the one that supposedly Regin stole the tattoo off her neck.
Yes.
Like, it's this one, which is that, like, legendary tale. So, that happened in the Third Era, if that happened. But she has Uriel the First, who's great lawmaker, apparently, and, like, the Fighters and Mages Guilds increase in prominence during this time. Generally speaking, the first 100-ish years of the Septim Dynasty is pretty decent. Like, there's nothing too insane.
I guess so. I mean, like, Uriel II, who comes in at year 64, and ruled for 18 years. He had like plagues and insurrections and basically accomplished nothing. But I suppose like compared to other things on the timeline of the Empire, it could be worse, is what
you're saying. It's still solid. Like you still have a united Tamriel. Solid. Yeah, still have a united Tamriel. Yeah, yeah, and at that point, like things always happen like that in empires in general. So,
Tiber Septim's reign was, you know, kind of referred to as the golden era, and it was always going to be downhill from there because he essentially brute forced the unification of Tamriel. You know, you've got some slightly shaky treaties like the Treaty of Strathmacai. You've got the armistice with Morrowind, and obviously just butchering millions of people in Somerset and even in elsewhere to bring everything together. It's like, oh yeah, well done, you've unified Tamriel. But when you then pass the buck on to your the future rulers, it's not going to stay that perfect for too long. You know, you can't really maintain that. You can brute force it, but you can't maintain it for a long time.
It's kind of like, as well, even in addition to it being hard to maintain such a huge, you know, area of land that was only kind of grabbed by brute force.
Mm.
It's kind of just like hard to keep it anyway when you think of like the cycle of revenge and all the people that hate you. Like you're going to unify the land, but you're going to make a lot of enemies in the process.
Yeah, exactly. You're not exactly putting kind of a common culture on all the races and all the provinces. They all have their own interests, and the second you leave their province, they're just going to get back on with their own thing, or they'll push you out, or whatnot. So, So it's when it does start to go a bit shaky with some of these emperors, it's like that was kind of inevitable that this would happen.
I guess so. We have Uriel II we just talked about, and then Pelagius II basically comes in with the debt of Uriel II.
I'm confused, just real quick, Pelagius II being the son or grandson of the dynasty, the thing they've got on the US wiki seems to look like a grandson.
Of Uriel Septim II?
Oh, no. I think it's just a weird layout of the thing. No, it's son. Yeah, yeah. So Pelagius Septim II, son of Uriel, he comes to the throne.
And he makes it all about money, man.
Yeah, he's arguably one of the most damaging of all of the emperors, because just dismissing people who were wise enough to be part of the Elder Council and replacing them with whoever would line his pockets the most,
He's got to get rid of that debt somehow, though, right? That the emperor before him made. But it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
And it's this sort of like era, really, that really kicks off a big dark phase, which becomes the War of the Red Diamond, where you have a whole bunch of intrigue with different sons and children and so on. But he has a bunch of kids, one of them being Antiochus Septim, Sepphoris Septim, Potima Septim, who you'll know, and also Magna Septim. So Queen Potima of Solitude and so on. So what happens is, as a young, it's kind of like when you read the Wolf Queen story, you can really kind of sympathize with the Wolf Queen quite a bit at points. And obviously it's a dramatization, like an in-world dramatization.
I mean, she's also a psycho.
But she's not originally. So she's a 14-year-old. She's a 14-year-old girl that gets married off to this old king,
Fat king.
So she's sent off to have kids with this kind of old dude, and she has a son who she calls Uriel.
Eventually, they tried for like many years, I believe, before she actually gave him a son.
Yeah. They call him Uriel and so on. But then basically Pelagius Septim II dies, and you get Antiochus Septim, who comes in, and he's a bit of a sort of a bastard, a bit of like going around just doing his own things, looking after himself. Apparently one of the most flamboyant of the usually austere Septim family. Many mistresses, nearly as many wives. You know, a real Dionysian sort of like, I'm the emperor, I do what I want, I have fun, I have parties, all of that kind of stuff. But Potima then doesn't like her brother and sort of tries to sort of start angling for the throne. And it really all takes place when Antiochus has a child who's came Kintyra, who becomes Kintyra Septim II, and she's a brief reign as an empress. But this is where the war kicks off, because Potima starts a war essentially. She wants Uriel Septim to become king, to become emperor and so on. And this is where the War of the Red Diamond kicks off. And I just need to like double check, so I don't want to make sure. I want to make sure that I don't like. It's a complicated story. There's a bunch of different stuff.
And she's only doing this because she has this demon wolf's werewolf soul. Like, well, there's the whole demon werewolf tale where it's in like the ring, basically.
Yeah. Yes. And if I remember, that everyone loses in this war, essentially, because Kintyra, is it confirmed that she's killed at the start of this war, or is it that her armies lose?
It's at the end, but then there's so what happens is there's this big complicated war. Like, we might have to like sort of like go into some details or something like that later. But there's that whole war happens, right? It's terrible. Uriel Septim III does end up. Her son becomes emperor for a little bit, but then he basically gets killed because she's fighting in a war against her other brothers, Sepphoris and Magnus. Kintyra has a really tragic story. She gets, I think she's imprisoned or dies in prison or something like that. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but it's a tragic sort of sad ending for her. So basically, Antiochus and Kintyra's line wiped. Now you're only dealing with Potima, with her son Uriel Septim the third, which is who she's announced as emperor. And then there's Sepphoris and Magnus, her two brothers that absolutely hate this idea. They're fighting against her. The wars happen back and forth. All of this stuff's happening for a long time. Potima starts getting desperate, starts using Daedra and necromancy and stuff like that. And then she goes quite mad when her son is killed. Uriel Septim the third is dead. So then things really escalate. And basically, Sepphoris and Magnus keep fighting against her and like restrict. Basically, she's in solitude and she's doing like last stand kind of stuff in solitude. All of her armies lose and everything. But then what happens is she disguises herself as an old crone or something like that. And then Magnus Septim's son is Pelagius Septim the third, who you may know as Pelagius Septim the Mad. She gifts him this little stone, like this old crone, like a young Pelagius or something, and that same like wolf queen stone diamond thing that made her a certain way, gives it to him, and then that's supposedly like what's made him so mad.
Yeah, because she had gotten that from her mother.
Yeah, so Quintilla, which is, you know, the most agreed upon name, was her mother. The whole story with Quintilla is that her and Pelagius the second, they basically are kind of like put together. But it says in The Wolf Queen, instead of wooing, Pelagius and Quintilla together went out to save the kingdom with sword and sorcery, and they slayed this demon werewolf. There's not a whole lot of description, like we don't really know much about it.
Was it part of the Grey Host? Was it, or is that...
Well, The Wolf Queen was written in by the time of Morrowind, so it's kind of like you get new details in the Elder Scrolls Online expansion. But that aside, the most important thing is that Quintilla decides, hey, you know what would be great? I'm going to put this demon werewolf soul inside a soul gem, because why not? Like, that's pretty cool. And Pelagius basically gets that stone, makes it into a ring, and uses this ring to marry Quintilla, right? So then when they have their child together, which you can assume was probably conceived when Quintilla was wearing this demon werewolf ring, that's when Potima is born. When Potima comes out, it was said that she was called like a little she-wolf on birth. Yeah. I can't remember exactly who by, but she was. And then she gets it. She, you know, she's crazy. All the stuff you explained, right? But then she gets the gem from the ring, puts it into a necklace, and then goes out from the Blue Palace, which is like her kind of like fortress of solitude that she's retreated to after things have gone south for her, and she dresses as kind of like this old lady and somehow gives this ring, this necklace now that it's made into, to, as a gift to Pelagius the third,
and
who becomes Pelagius the Mad.
And to like clarify, sabotage his line for the timeline there. So we had Antiochus and Kintyra dead. Then the Uriel Septim the third, Potima's son, emperor for a little bit, but then he dies. Then there's the war rages on. Potima's just trying to like throw everything she can and just like do whatever she can,
making deals with Daedra, everything.
Yeah. But then the throne, there's all deposed. Uriel's dead. So then Sepphoris becomes emperor, but he basically has a short run. I think he might even fell off his horse or something and broke.
Yeah, it's such a bad way to go, isn't it? Like back but, then, they'd be like, "Oh, those horses." It'd be like car accidents.
Yeah,
died in a horse crash.
But then it goes to Magnus Septim, and he already has a son, Pelagius the Third. So when Potima, disguised as a crone, is giving it to a young Pelagius, Magnus is currently the emperor. But obviously, that reign ends, and then the throne ends up going to Pelagius Septim the Third. Mm-hmm. Which is a bit of a story in itself. I just want to find out the.
So she smiled when she knew she was going to die, because she's kind of like, not only have I like caused so much chaos and civil war, but I've also ensured that the empire going forward is going to be chaotic and have issues because I've made the emperor nuts.
Yeah, and the. So now you have like Magnus the First. He's kind of has a shit time of it because he's trying to repair all the damage done in the War of the Red Diamond, which was a really bad and pretty prolonged conflict. And then he arranges a marriage between his son Pelagius and Kateria of Clan Rathim, who is the Duchess of Vardenfell.
So this is a dark elf.
Yeah, a dark elf thing. And this is where you get another little bit of extra controversy is Pelagius the Third is obviously Pelagius the Mad, and he's quite mad. He goes insane, and basically he is deemed as unfit to rule, and I forget which island he's, I'll have to look it up, what island, or he's put away somewhere. I forget where it is. Sorry.
It's in Blackmarsh somewhere?
Temple of Kinner. I think he was
maybe
in...
Maybe not.
No. I think that's the Kintyra.
Yeah, that's where she goes.
She goes and gets locked away. But it's like he dies... Pelagius Septim III eventually dies, actually, in his cell on the Temple of Kinnereth on the Isle of Bethany. Mm-hmm. But basically, he does a whole... You can go look into the Madness Pelagius. He does a whole bunch of bombastic things and so on. But basically, he's seen as unfit. So his wife, the Dark Elf, Kateria Rathim, ends up becoming the empress. So here's another example. It's like she's not related at all. There's no blood relation here. And so I don't know how she looked, like the Dragonfire stuff or
that's what I mean. It's obviously a blessing from, because when you try it, as the listeners can tell, when you try and map this all out and make sense of it, there's a lot of times where the dynasty doesn't exactly make the most sense. And it's kind of like one of those things where it is what it is, but then it retroactively tries to get made sense of, like, oh, you're this heir, you're connected from this, and so on.
And also, based on the idea that the race of the child is based on the mother, you then have Dark Elf rule emperors for the next two generations.
Well,
so Pelagius the Third and Kateria have one child called Cassander Septim. Who would probably be Dark Elf, given that kind of thing, right? So Cassander Septim is the next in line, but she remarries. Kateria, after Pelagius' death, remarries to a guy called Galavir Lariat.
Yeah.
And they have a son called Uriel Lariat. But what happens is, I think it's Cassander grows old and doesn't have any children or something. But basically, he had a short rule, only had 2 years on the throne, but his succeeded adopted half brother, because I think the half brother Uriel Lariat was like adopted into the family legally. So legally, Uriel Septim the Fourth was a septim in law, but not by blood, because that's it's a child from Kateria and this Lariat fellow. So then you have Uriel Septim the Fourth, and I can't remember, does Andorak actually get a run at it? Which is,
I don't think there's any mention of it.
It goes from Uriel the Fourth to Sepphoris Septim the Second.
So basically the Andorak Septim gets passed over, because when Uriel Septim the Fourth dies, Uriel Septim the Fourth has a child called Andorak, and they're like, no, we're not picking Andorak as the new heir, because, you know, they basically pick a more distant cousin that is supposedly more closely related to Type Septim, and that's this Sepphoris Septim the Second. So when you see the Sepphoris Septim the Second stuff, there's this huge break in the family tree. It's like, oh, just pick a distant cousin. So already you've got all of the original Septim dynasty for the first 140 years or whatever of the Third Era comes from direct descendants of Tiber Septim's brother, Agnareth, through Kintyra, and so on. And then even at this point, they just pick some sort of like distant cousin kind of situation. So you can see how like a lot of the Septim dynasty is pretty... this whole idea of like Martin Septim, my ancestor, Tiber Septim, War is Arvarol, it's a bit like, ooh, a bit shaky.
And it seems this is where the line of emperors strays away from being kind of Breton of origin and Nordic again, because Sepphoris II is a Nord.
Yeah,
I think because I mean, if you buy into Tiber Septim and his kin all being Bretons as opposed to Nords,
yeah, he's noted as the first non-Breton, or the first to not spend any point of their childhood in High Rock.
Yeah, Nordic descent does say as well.
Yeah, placed. Yeah. In
so we've got essentially we have a completely new dynasty at this point. If that didn't already happen sometime in the previous dynasty,
he's a Nordic nobleman with sympathies from Skyrim and Morrowind, and is detested by the Bretons of High Rock.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So you're straying quite far away
Welcome
now.
Welcome to the party.
Yeah, so...
But let's just go with the name Septim,
He gives birth to Uriel Septim the Fifth, right?
Yeah, well, so the thing is, I think Sepphoris must have left it in a good spot, the empire. Because when Uriel the Fifth gets Sepphoris' second son, gets hold of the empire... The Empire's actually a pretty sweet spot. They've got, like, lots of stuff. So it's like, well, what am I going to do with this big, like, long-standing army, which is run off taxes and all of this kind of stuff? What are we going to do? Let's invade. Let's invade Akavir. And this is the infamous Akaviri invasion. So, in a way, like, I feel like this era is much better than the mid. Like, there's the sort of, like, the first 100 years or Tiber Septim up to about the War of the Red Diamond is pretty decent. Then there's this whole like screwy part in the middle where you have the War of the Red Diamond, you have mad emperors, you have emperors or an empress that's not even of the Septim dynasty, and then adopted half brothers, like, you know, they basically need a reset and like go to this cousin, and then that cousin Sepphoris Septim the Second, who has Uriel Septim the Fifth, and Uriel Septim the Fifth
goes to Akavir and dies, and then,
yeah,
and then things go downhill. Things go downhill again.
Well, you have...
You'd think there'd be enough at home to keep him occupied, eh? I feel like you got to, like, really, like...
Yeah,
it's... Keep Tamriel in your grips, as, like, you know, make that solid, thick, tight before you go off to Akavir and die.
Mm.
So Uriel, there's a Uriel Septim the Sixth.
I think he's the one who has had the most positive impact since... You know, we mentioned earlier, I'm forgetting which one it was now, which Uriel, I think it might have been Uriel the Second or Pelagius the Second, who essentially sold the Elder Council to the highest bidder. I think it might have been Pelagius the Second. I'm going mad now with all these names.
I'm pretty sure.
Uriel Six is the one who falls off his horse and dies.
Yeah.
Because Uriel,
but before that, he does some good stuff.
Because Uriel the Six, so first, Uriel Six was only a baby. Only just born when Uriel the Fifth goes off and dies in Akavir. Mm-hmm. So he, basically his mother, the consort Thonica, was basically had a restricted regency until he reached maturity. The Elder Council retained the real power, as they had since Katariah. The council so enjoyed its unlimited and unrestricted freedom to make laws and profits. Uriel VI was not given full license to rule until 307 when he was 22 years old. He'd been slowly assuming positions of responsibility for years, but both the council and his mother, who enjoyed even her limited regency, were loath to give him reign. By the time came to throne, the mechanisms of government gave him little power but the power to veto. So it seems like he didn't have a whole lot of power.
But he did eventually. He used his veto all the time.
Yeah.
So
and then he basically...
Yeah, it says he utilized defunct spy networks and guard units to bully and coerce the difficult members of the Elder Council.
Based.
And with the help of his half-sister, Mora Hafa. So there's a quote that says, Uriel the Fifth conquered Ezrianet, so that's the island on the way to Akavir, but Uriel the Sixth conquered the Elder Council and essentially returned the power of the Emperor to the Emperor.
Yeah, and it's also... This whole era, these kind of emperors that we're talking about now, these are really the ones that kind of lay the groundwork for Uriel Septim the Seventh to have a good time, basically, mm-hmm. like a golden piece of things. But we have, he's a half-sister. Uriel Septim the Sixth doesn't have a kid, and falls off his horse, dies. But then it goes to his half-sister, which was Morahath the Septim, which was a child by Uriel Septim the Fifth and someone else. We don't know who that was yet. And Morahatha has a sister. There were twins. Eliza, would you say that? It's E-L-O-I-S-A. Or
Eloisa.
Eloisa, probably. And Eloisa and someone else have a kid, Pelagia Septim the Fourth. So Morahatha never ends up having children herself. But then, so then it goes to her nephew, Pelagia Septim the Fourth. So already we've got a lot of like sideways-ing of the family tree. But you have Pelagia Septim the Fourth, who seemed to basically, I'm pretty sure by this point, you know, he continued his aunt's work, slowly bringing back the seditious kingdoms of the empire. And then basically by this point, he had consolidated a lot of stuff. It's basically, same, according to Brief History of the Empire, I think it is, saying that he had an astonishing 29-year reign and Tamriel was stable, prosperous, and closer to unity than it had been since the days of Uriel the First.
So this is Eloise's son.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is also Uriel Septim the Seventh's father. So Uriel Septim the Seventh, you know, the emperor we're most familiar with, like, you know, for all of the games up to Oblivion, he is, like, an important character. And he is...
He gets put in a box by Yegar Tharn.
Yeah. Well, first, like, too,
that's heavy, but like it's good reign. Except that time I was impersonated and captured for years.
At first, he's a bit of a beast. He's like a real like, you know, savvy, like political, like, you know, he's not afraid to twist arms and make things happen. And he perseveres like keeping this peace, but really until Jaegar Tharn, who is his imperial battle mage, sort of plays this sort of like role as like a like an outpaced former master kind of thing. So Uriel gets cocky and a little bit blindsided. He's got a blind
spot. Bit of his worm tongue.
Yeah, exactly. And then like Jaegar Tharn, puts him in a box. Basically, in Oblivion, he gets trapped in Oblivion for 10 years, which obviously, in terms of the end, Jaegar Tharn impersonates the emperor. And this is terrible for the empire. It basically, you know, spreads paranoia everywhere that nobles have been replaced by the emperors. There's wars going on nonstop in all of these different provinces.
It would like be crazy. Like, in terms of the paranoia, I mean, like, for those of you who remember from Fallout 4, the whole feeling of, like, you're a synth. That... You'd very much like imagine you had a leader who was actually just them, but they did something which you thought was weird. You'd always be like, is that really them? Is this another imposter? Is the real leader I know trapped in a plane of Oblivion? Like, it would mess with your head.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it does seem that even though, you know, like, he's obviously very hardy, because 10 years in exile in Oblivion, like plagued by nightmares, would break most people. And while he comes back less kind of like brazen and making big bold moves, he still seems to keep his intellect, and he's very cunning and prudent in his decision making, and continues to be a pretty good ruler all the way up until his assassination.
And so, just to clarify for people in case they don't know, the events of Arena is you thwarting Jaegar Tharn and rescuing the real emperor. So that's the Eternal Champion character. And then throughout the... And it's funny, it's like you can kind of like speculate that maybe his time in Oblivion gave him some kind of insight, because what he starts doing through covert means is he just starts using the blades a lot, for starters, but then also he just seems to pick these prophetic heroes. He's like, I'm gonna use this agent of the blades, who's basically going to go sort the whole warp in the west kind of thing, the events of Daggerfall, and fix the situation there through a miracle, basically. Next, he's going to pick, this prisoner, I'm going to send you to Vardenfell. Oh, and that prisoner fulfills the Nerevarine prophecy.
He's got that ESP. He's kind of got like some psychic... Maybe when he was locked away in Oblivion... Whatever nightmares he had to endure for 10 years, kind of like, he got humbled, came back without being so ballsy, but he was kind of like, bit of Oblivion still in me. And I'm
honestly,
like,
it That does seem to be the case, because there's a lot of mention of him having waking and sleeping nightmares when he's exiled. And then when he comes back, you know, like talking to the champion of Cyrodiil in the sewers, mm-hmm. it's like, you're the one from my dreams. Yeah. So it seems that maybe his time imprisoned in this pocket realm has given him like a prophetic ability to see the future in his dreams. And he's, you know,
well, and then
obviously seems to work out.
And then, yeah, he entrusts the final, the prisoner in Oblivion, the game, and entrust you with the Amulet of Kings, and you go off and you save the world, the hero of Kvatch, even, you know, from the Oblivion Crisis. But it's, you gotta say, and like, he is the MVP of impressiveness in terms of he was handed the place in a good spot, but he brought it to like this awesome stage. He went to Oblivion for 10 years, impersonated so much damage and everything done, and then he pulls it back. All of that, undoes that damage, brings it back, spends that time getting it, has a few bit of Golden Peace years, and then all of a sudden, Oblivion Crisis, and then that ruins everything. Like, considering the circumstances, pretty impressive.
And even then, it seems that he foresees his own assassination, you know, whether or not something could have been done about it, or whether he had accepted that fate. It's hard to say, but then, you know, his bastard son will actually go on to save Tamriel from this Oblivion Crisis as well. So,
and then
even after death, he's doing good stuff.
Yeah. And I guess Martin, as we know from Oblivion, then essentially sacrifices himself to defeat Mehrunes Dagon in the Temple of the One. And so they say, so ends the Septim Dynasty. Though we know the Septim Dynasty is a meme anyway. But Martin, if we are speaking about heirs, may have sons as well based on his past. You know, we know he's mentioned having once possessed Sanguine's Rose, and kind of sounds like he ran with a cult of Sanguine worshippers who are all about that debaucherous life, you know.
Yeah, it is interesting assessing how the legitimacy of the Mead Dynasty in context of like the Septim Dynasty is not that like crash hot. Like, because arguably, like, I wonder if, like, I don't know. Like, arguably, I'd even say the whole Uriel Septim the Seven stuff. Like, you got to take the word for it that this Sephiroth II, where it all comes from, is some distant cousin that is. But then I'm like, yeah, I don't know.
It's kind of just one of those situations with the Empire where the most powerful or influential surrounding king or lord from one of the regions like Kolovia or High Rock ends up just taking the Ruby Throne, and everyone just accepts that your power has kind of put you there. Maybe like in some form or another, that's what Sephiroth the Second has done. But I mean, like, you know, it's not really the topic of this video, but you got to give some credit to the Mead Dynasty, because Titus Mead the First did a pretty good job of, you know, coming in and organizing things after the chaos that was left by the Oblivion Crisis.
Just real quick as well, it is interesting to think, because the Empire, like the first Empire, not the third one, started by Alicia, I'm talking about. That one, you know, that's when all the Amulet of King Dragonfires stuff. That's,
I think the Dragonfires was Reman.
Right, but whole Amulet of Kings and all of that was from before. And then you look at all the emperors that you've had since then, of all different races groups and different groups and factions that, you know.
Well, like Alesius was all that, like, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, even the whole thing of keeping the Daedra at bay, I guess you almost have to look at it like Akatosh is trying his best. Because there's been plenty of times where there's kind of like, obviously, there's the plots that kind of work around it with, like, the least amount of plot holes. But then there are just those moments where it's like, oh, this Daedra just comes into Tamriel. Just because.
Yeah, it happens. And every time there's new content added to the Elder Scrolls in some form or another, it's another Daedric invasion. So, yeah.
Arguably,
you know,
perhaps you've got the situation with the Mead Dynasty is what makes it sort of so, like, contentious, is that it has the least, like, mythologized reasoning for why its dynasty exists. So, for example, carrying on from Alesia, you've got kind of the Alesian line kind of ends and, like, disrupts everything, blows up with the Alesian order, and stuff all happens there. But then you have the mythology surrounding Reman the First, which is that he is basically the spirit, ghost, or whatever, of Alesia, basically banging a hill. King Froll banging the land itself, Cyrodiil, and with
what
the ghost.
What do you mean,
and so on
banging
there.
It?
Well, he puts
very fertile soil.
Just to clarify, because a lot of people who don't know that story would, I don't know, you just think banging a hill, like, not,
yeah, he
not
just
sex.
Sees a molehill and he thinks, is that Elysia? I'm gonna go, and there's some moles just trying to live his life.
But so then Reman the First is like taken by this shepherdess and so on, and he is born with the amulet of kings on his head, like a full speaking adult lady, but he is
so
literally
trippy.
Like descended from the land itself, from Elysia's spirit and intertwined. So there is a mythological reasoning to take Reman dynasty, Elysian dynasty connected. I'm trying to think of what the type of septum one is. Like, obviously they spin the whole like Talos of Atmora kind of thing, and the sort of like dragonbornish kind of connection, but it's not
because
as...
well, there is elements of that that you really can't tell what the truth is. So, you know, just briefly going over it, you obviously have whether this like Tiber Septim actually had dragonborn powers and could use the way of the voice, or whether it was just Ismir Wolfarth. You've got the story of the assassination where, you know, Kula Kane was killed and supposedly Tiber Septim's throat was slit, which stopped him from being able to shout, and he had to rule the empire with just a whisper, that, you know, all of his rulings were done by a whisper. And in reality, if that happened now, you'd see the mythology, like the mythos, and say, oh, this is just... it's just a story. It's not true. But it's far enough back that you kind of have to question, oh, is that just a metaphor for the fact he was quiet spoken and didn't like to show his power? Or did he really survive having his throat cut and he was just this godlike being? So you can't really afford that kind of mythological aspect to modern rulers like Titus Mead, because we can all see it. And
yeah.
The history is so recent.
And I think too, it's a good lens to look at the Elder Scrolls through. Sometimes to check it is almost like a bit more of the, like the, there's a realistic version of events. Like, for example, like even the inspiration being off, like, you know, the Roman Empire and so on. You had like emperors that, like, you know, they proclaim divinity and they're like, they become like these god figures. Throughout history, a lot of people try and create sources like some sort of metaphysical, spiritual reasoning or something as to why they're the chosen, they're divine themselves or whatever. Like, so there is like a myth that keeps getting perpetrated and so on, that they are divine for this reason. And it's interesting to look at it instead of perhaps a little less literal. It's a bit more...
I feel like it makes it easier in those societies, or I don't know if this is a bad take, but I feel like it can almost make it easier in those societies for the lower classes to kind of like accept the way that things are, because it's just like, well, I mean even just like mentally, like, well, I'm not divine, I was born like this. Whereas nowadays, without that metaphysical kind of aspect to it, it's kind of like, well, I'm here because of, you know, insert list of bad things, politicians, corporations, this, that. Whereas before it was like, it was the same bullshit, but it was, well, just like, I'm divine though. So it's kind of like, oh, he's divine. So.
Yeah, I think I said it before in maybe the File podcast or maybe One Civilization, but basically that, like, if only the peasant knew that all that divided his position and the king's position is just a good story.
Yeah,
like that's all it is. I think that's like in our history, it's like everywhere, and it's been it's only until really recently that it's kind of gone downhill. Mm-hmm. Like, even if the realistic reasons behind the scenes is like, you know, political maneuvering and all that kind of stuff, the presentation eventually is that there is some sort of like, you know, divine right to rule kind of thing. And
I guess we should get back to the so after Martin dies, you have Accardo, who's not like the emperor necessarily. He basically becomes a potentate, and then he gets assassinated. And then a very interesting character, Nibbany's witch warrior. Would you call that Thules the Gibbering?
I would say Thules.
But... Thules the Gibbering was crowned emperor. Not liked, but liked by the Elder Council more than Titus Mead. And perhaps that's because, I mean, there's two ways to look at that. Perhaps there's some witch warrior, he kind of had some charm kind of magic on them. Or perhaps it really is just like, this witch warrior is really easy to control and we don't want Titus Mead because he's this crazy conqueror. And eventually Titus Mead does basically capture the Imperial City.
So I think you would have like, I think it was, so it was Accardo was for 10 years or something, and then this Thules the Gibbering only gets taken out by Titus Mead in 4E17. So he's at about 7 years of Thules the Gibbering kind of rule, which is interesting because, like, again, like, it's easier when you're like
skimming through. It's the Elder Council rules, but really.
Yeah. But when you're like skimming through all of these dates and stuff, it's very easy to just like not conceptualize it in real, like, kind of like time.
But, I know.
Like, 17 years ago, you know, for like us, you're like children and so on.
17.
So, like,
yeah, I know. It's
like, it's
even so, 7 years ago. I mean, think about how long we had, the Liberal Party in Australia. Like, that's a long time. Like, think of your life while they're in power. That's a long time. So you can imagine how it would have felt with these just random emperors in for this many years or that many years. But anyway, Titus Meade basically, it was like a Kluvian warlord. He captures the imperial city from this Thules the Gibbering character and crowns himself emperor of this Meade dynasty. And he kind of does the classic conqueror cope where he persuades the Elder Council, like, I'm not a conqueror, I'm a liberator. And they're kind of like, well, he just captured the imperial city, so okay.
Yeah.
And then he basically goes and reclaims Hammerfell, and the city-states Breville and Leowin and elsewhere and all of this. But then, of course, eventually, ultimately, you get Titus Meade II descending to the throne in 168. And he is kind of like, you know, by the time of Skyrim especially, viewed as this weak leader, and many people don't like him.
Yeah, because the, yes, because like even the whole Meade dynasty empire, it's like, remember the, there was no Valenwood for most of it, no Valenwood or Somerset Isles, and I think Blackmarsh is pretty quick out of it. The whole Morrowind status is very like, weird to say or hard to say. I don't know if they're like actually part of the empire anymore. Well, I know some of the maps do, but the sources sort of seem different.
Well,
I don't know.
With the fourth era, you kind of really are starting from scratch, because when the Oblivion Crisis happened, the empire lost so much respect from just about everyone, and Morrowind is the perfect example of that, because in Morrowind, most of the houses and most of the populace didn't like the empire, but there were some people like House Lalu who were actually fairly loyal. But then the Imperials pull out all of their soldiers from Morrowind during the crisis, leaving Morrowind to get completely screwed so that they can protect their own province. They just, not only is the Empire greatly weakened by the crisis, but they also lose a lot of respect from all of their vassal kingdoms and vassal provinces. So when you've got the Fourth Era and you've got Thules the Gibbering or whatever coming along, people don't really care about them or respect them. And even when they do reclaim little bits of land, they're just not an influential power anymore. And that never really came back.
It really seems like for most of it, I know Elsewhere leaves a little bit later, but and joins the Unmarried Dominion. But like, it really does seem that it's an empire of men only now. Like, you know, it's Red Guards, Nords, Bretons, and Imperials, like Hammerfell, Cyrodiil, Harrow, Skyrim.
Even the name Gibbering kind of like implies, like what I was saying, that he was this kind of like idiot, like some kind of babbling idiot that's easy to control.
Yeah. But yeah, we only know of like three emperors: the Titus Meade the first, second, and there was Atropos Meade, which is the son of Titus Meade the first. But and he's one of the main characters in the sort of Lord of Souls, Infernal City novels. And then presumably he became emperor because he was like the crown prince at one point. But there's a little bit of a gap in our understanding. But Titus the Meade II's been an emperor for a while, but obviously he signed the White Gold Concordat, Talos stuff got outlawed, worship, and he's hated for a bunch of those different reasons. And there's an elaborate plot where he assassinated himself via the Dark Brotherhood to get over it.
The thing is with Titus Meade II, as we do kind of see with the way he responds to his assassination and the kind of maturity, and he seems like a very good diplomatic leader who would have been very useful at some points in the Septim Dynasty. But when you've got the Empire as it was post-Oblivion Crisis, where even getting some land back and reforming some of the Empire, it really needed powerful displays. And you can't really have a kind diplomatic leader in these situations when you've got the Old Merry Dominion that are coming back with a force, and they're relentless in achieving their goals. So someone like Titus Meade II, while he seems like a good emperor, was never going to garner a great deal of respect, and he was never going to achieve a great deal at the time he came to rule.
Yeah.
And it led inevitably to everything, like the Great War.
it's that thing too. It's like even because of the whole like Hammerfell thing. It's like, oh, Hammerfell, maybe they could have won the Great War. It's like hindsight's 20/20. Like, man, like a lot of people in his position would have just taken the deal, you know, end the war, end the bloodshed kind of thing. Like it was, you know what I mean? Like it's not as simple as just.
And I mean, if it wasn't for, you know, we can get into the Stormcloaks as well, but that's a huge conversation. But if it wasn't for some of the other provinces being a bit rash about how they respond to this White Gold Concordat, you can imagine that Titus Mead II would have been, you know, thinking about it. And he's like, okay, we'll take this agreement to kind of stop the Old Merry Dominion's relentless advance. And then we can take our time to kind of recoup and strengthen ourselves. And it's kind of just it's a meaningless treaty that they can just break at some point anyway. You know, like the idea that because they've at their weakest moment have signed this White Gold Concordat and capitulated to the High Elves, I highly doubt that they would do that unless they desperately needed to. So when they're in a more powerful position, that's when you strike back. Don't all start rebelling and then just crumble even further and just hand it to the Dominion.
It depends, though. I mean, the Red Guards fought them off and they thought that, I don't know. It's so hard to know as well. Like, this is the thing when, like, you have, like, an emperor who can kind of call the shots. It's like, he may have thought that, other people may have disagreed. I guess the thing is, and I guess it's not necessarily better or worse, but when you do sign a treaty like that and delay things and you have, you know, time to rebuild, they do as well. So it's kind of just like, you know, like they're not stupid. They're not going to be like, haha, they are bending to us and we're not going to bolster our own forces anymore. Like everyone will use that time as efficiently as they can. You can assume.
But using the time thing as well, it's like the Great War, like it's like, the Great War ended 25 years ago by the time of Skyrim. Like that has allowed for peace for a whole generation of people like our age to grow up and be like, hey, that's cool. Like we didn't have to live through war for 25
I guess
years.
The men breed faster. So they've got a higher like regenerate.
Yeah. But it is that thing. It's like in terms of like the desire for like peace, like, cause it's in the games and like lore and stuff. You can really like, yeah, it's all about beating the enemy and like beating the big monsters or the Thelm or the enemy or whatever. But like, most of the populace would love to not be in constant wartime.
Yeah, of course, like, absolutely.
Everybody loses in war, man.
There's the real red pill.
Yeah.
True story.
But I think...
on that philosophical note.
Yeah, we'll wrap up on that philosophical note.
I think that covers pretty much everything Third Empire, like the dynasty-wise and so on. Like,
no, it's an interesting one because there's like a lot of complexity, but it's interesting the more you dig into it and kind of like think of it in a holistic way and, you know, how it would have been like living through each of those reigns for the people and all that societal kind of stuff I really like.
And one last note too is like that every single of the empires have always had some sort of like poor ending. So like there's the Elysian Empire, it starts as a few emperors and then it becomes basically co-opted by the Elysian Order, sort of theocracy basically, so it doesn't really feel like, you know, it's not this like continued line kind of thing. Then you've got the, you know, the Riemann stuff that basically gets co-opted by the Akaviri potentates that run the joint for like longer than the Riemann dynasty even did, so that continues the Second Empire. Third Empire, you have like the War of the Red Diamond and the sort of like all of these different breaks and stuff, but the Third Empire ends up getting, you know, run by the Mead dynasty. It's a continuation.
It would be so weird being a citizen of the Empire. Like, you're like, oh, okay, it's snake people now. Yeah. And like, there would be a group of people, like, you know, you talk about lifespans, especially of the human races, who would grow up and all they know is snake people leaders.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of a trip sometimes. But that all said and done, social media links are in the description. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we look forward to nerding out with you again next time.